As this is my last opportunity, let me say thank you for the invitation to be here. When I hear from Wayne, I always have this cognitive disconnect because in my mind, Wayne is 12 years old. I mean, that's when I knew him. I mean, how old is he, David? I mean, he's just a kid. Well, he's a kid who grew into a good man, an excellent gospel preacher, a great friend to anyone who loves the truth, and as can be attested by this event, an excellent organizer. I'm sure that you and Kathy must be very proud. And I'm grateful now to have him as an adult friend. I always thought he was a great kid, and now he's a great friend. And I do appreciate the invitation to be with you. I hope that you have been encouraged by whatever it is that I've been able to offer, because I've been extremely encouraged by you, by being in your presence, by being able to be a part of this event. I'd heard about it for years. April was here last year, but this was my first opportunity, and I'm very grateful. I feel like I'm the one who received the blessing. I appreciated very much Neil's comments in the previous hour, although I have to tell you that he just stomped all over my toes. I feel like I need to go back into local work to get a second shot. Maybe I can do it better this time. So I do appreciate his comments very much. I'm not sure what I accomplished yesterday morning. I say that because when I finished, the first comment that I received was from Tim Burrows, and he said, "I want to thank you. I want to thank you for giving me a license not to counsel." So that license cost $12.95. I charged him, and now he has a license not to counsel. And now, then I have received a steady stream of you asking further questions, saying, "You know, I've been on the fence about this. I think I'm going to have to go ahead and bite the bullet and get some training in how to do this." So I'm not exactly sure, you know, how that could be taken in diametrically opposite ways, but evidently you did. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm so wishy-washy you can't tell where I am. Hopefully that's not the case. Today what I'd like to do for just the next few minutes is to turn our attention to some biblical principles that work in counseling. Now, yesterday the message basically was, if you find yourself in a position of people expecting of you to counsel them, yet you're ill-equipped to do so or unequipped to do so, get yourself some training. Recognize what your current limitations are and be willing to reach beyond that to help yourself. One of the things that you can do, even without being a formally trained counselor, is to respond to them lovingly. And we talked about that yesterday from the standpoint of caring about the person or persons who are seeking your help. And that responding lovingly oftentimes means that you are willing to do what is difficult to do. You're willing to extend yourself further maybe than you are comfortable. You're willing to say to them what they need to hear, even if it is unpleasant to be said, unpleasant to be heard, and it may even require that they begin examining themselves in ways that they haven't before and won't enjoy. Somebody says, "But as a counselor, aren't we supposed to make people feel better?" No, that's not our job. Our job as a counselor is to help people be better. And that doesn't always start with feeling better. I oftentimes warn clients that in the process of this, you may feel much worse before you begin to get better. Now, eventually, you'll be happier because you will be healthier. But it won't necessarily come the other way. And it isn't our job as counselors to make people feel. You know, sometimes a person may have put him or herself in a life situation where they shouldn't feel good. When I read the psychology textbooks and the counseling textbooks, one of the things that constantly comes up is, here's what you need to do to help your clients get over their feelings of guilt. I don't use any of those techniques. Sometimes a person needs to feel guilty. What have you done? Have you made it right? You should feel guilty about that. Have we not from the pulpit from time to time said, I hope that this lesson convicts you in such a way that you are incapable of eating or sleeping until you make it right? What we are doing is we are calling upon a natural, God-given part of ourselves that makes us feel guilty when we do wrong. If you've got clients who feel guilty because they've done wrong and haven't made it right, work with that. What do they need? They need to get rid of the guilt. How? By using some kind of a technique to make them feel better about being where they are? No, that's not what they need. What they need to do is they need to make it right, at which point you can sit down with them and say, at this point God says you have no reason to feel guilty. The blood of His Son takes care of that. Perfectly. Now, no more guilt. Isn't that so much better than a psychological technique that does the person no good? So we work with oftentimes what comes to us. Now, in the world of psychology and in the counseling world, they see a man as this big merry-go-round with three different sections. And there's a running debate that's been going on for decades as to where do you get on the merry-go-round? You've got a big pot, slice of the pie that's cognitive. What does a person think? What are his thinking patterns in general? And when specific triggering events occur in his life, how does he respond in his thinking to those things? Then you've got another big wedge of the pie that is affect, emotion. How do you feel about that? And by the way, in good counseling, you never ever mutter the words, how does that make you feel? Okay? That's for television. It doesn't work. They don't know how they feel. If they knew how they felt, they probably wouldn't be talking to you. And asking them, how did that make you feel, will bring the age-old productive response, I don't know. And they don't know. So don't ask that. There are many other ways to go about that that are far more effective. But that second piece of the pie is what we feel. Then the third piece of the pie is how we behave, what we do. And the debate is, where do you actually get on? What is it that affects? And the truth of the matter is, it is in fact, we'll say circular. It's actually helical, but that's a technical distinction. What we think affects the way that we behave, which affects the way that we feel, which changes the way that we think. And if you don't like that order of things, rearrange it. It still works. This is interwoven. You can't take one without the other. But everybody needs a place to start. Where do you start? Biblical principle number one, effective counseling starts with the cognitive. Now, where do we get that? I'm reading from Proverbs chapter 23, beginning in verse 6. Eat thou not the bread of him that hath an evil eye, neither desire thou his dainty meats. For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, saith he, but his heart is not with thee. Now, most of us recognize the phrase, as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. But we don't keep it within its context. We'll come back to that in a moment. But this is telling me that who I am as a person is based on how I think. What I think about, whether or not my thought processes are generally positive or generally negative. Have you met people that it doesn't matter what happens, it's always bad? Now, I don't mean that you only are associated with them in times of tragedy. An airplane with $1 billion could crash in their front yard and somebody could come by and say, finders keepers, it's all yours. And they would say, really messed up the yard. Why? Because every reaction mentally begins with the negative. It's almost as though they go out of their way to find a way to think about it badly. That's their thought process. That's not very productive. And it's not very helpful. And if you're working with that person, you're going to have to find, we'll use some fancy words. If you use cognitive behavioral therapy, we call it reframing. That's another way of saying, I'm trying to get you to think about this differently. If you like narrative therapy, we call it rewriting. This is the story of your life, and you're writing the chapters as you live them. And you've got an opportunity here to wipe out this negative language that you've been using and rewrite that with some positive language. Okay, so we've got a couple of names for it. What is the process? The process is we need to change the way you think about things. So how do you do that? Can you get inside a person's head and begin wandering around in there and reordering thoughts for them? Boy, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Just get you a toolkit, open up the brain, reorder things, clamp it all down, pat it on the hood, and tell them they're ready to go. Doesn't work that way. So how is it that we engage with a person's thoughts? Well, we measure and work with the cognitive through the vocal. There's your principle number two. This is also from Scripture, is it not? Well, let's see. Matthew chapter 9, I'm reading beginning in verse number 3. Behold, certain of the scribes, listen to the words carefully, said within themselves, this man blasphemeth. And Jesus, knowing their, what's the word? Thoughts. How do I get in touch with the person's cognitive processes? I've got to go through their language. There's a connection, a God-designed connection between our thinking and our words. Anybody here ever tried to learn a foreign language on your own? I did this. I was going to learn Spanish. I thought that'd be helpful. I like Mexican food. So I went down to the library, and there I got a set of cassette tapes. That tells you how long ago this was I had this idea. I got this box full of cassette tapes. I was working a job at the time where I drove about 60,000 miles a year. I thought, we're going to make this productive time. I'm going to be ordering off the menu just any day. Well, I am ordering off the menu, but I still don't know Spanish. I know just enough to get fed. Pop in the tape. Tape number one, side A. What's the very first instruction that they give you when you're trying to learn another language? Come on, this is not rhetorical. I'm sorry?
Say it.
Say it. Say it to myself quietly and humbly. In my mind, I'm going to say it. No. That's not what they say. You said it. Say it out loud. Why? Because saying things engages a portion of our brain that thinking them doesn't engage. And what you're going to have to do to learn this language is you're going to have to go through a thinking process. And at some point, your brain's done everything it can do silently. And now, to get your brain further engaged, you're going to have to make a commitment to it and say it out loud. And if you don't do that, you'll drive all over North Mississippi, 60,000 miles a year. You'll be hearing all kinds of Spanish, and you'll still know taco and burrito. I'm your example. Why? There's a connection between how our brain processes and what our mouth says. Doesn't the Bible teach us this? A good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, I hope we know that's not this when the Bible's talking about the heart. Out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good. Evil man, out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil. For of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. Right? Your brain is tied to your mouth. Putting new shingles on the house. Not a lot of fun. Hit thumb with hammer. Less fun. Stream of profanity. I'm sorry. That's not who I am. Wait a minute, brother. Where did it come from? What you've just done is you've created a situation where your words, for the moment, were unguarded. But you know what they were? They were your words. Yes, I understand they were unguarded. If you had the time to stop and think about what you were about to say, you would have chosen not to say those words. But they're inside you. What kind of music have you been listening to? Boy, music gets in our brain. What kind of television have you been watching? What do you consider a good movie? These words are in you, but they came from someplace. They're a measure of what's happening in my mind. They are an example of my cognitive processes. They're in me. I sit down with a client and they begin telling me about their life. I listen minutely to their words because it's the best I can do. If I had the choice of prying open their head and seeing what their thoughts were, I would do it. Since I can't do that, I try to connect with what's happening in their mind by listening so closely. By the way, I turn this process around when it comes time to start treating. I begin to be very picky about the way they talk about things. When I've got a client who then begins to say things like, "This will never be any better." I'm sorry. Let me stop you just a moment. I realize it's picky. But your words and your thoughts are tied together, and I can't have you thinking that way because you're not going to get better. So we've got to take the word "never" out of there. Give me a different word. But it is never. Okay, in that case, we're going to have to change some other word. We can't have this. If this is the way you're thinking, we're never going to improve. So if the word "never's" got us, then let's try this. It feels like this will never get any better. Oh, okay, we can work with that because that's the way it feels right now. But it's not always going to feel that way because it is going to get better. But I need you to start talking about it that way now because your thoughts and your words are tied together and you're reinforcing this thing that's beating you up all the time and you're making it stronger every time you talk about it like it is insurmountable. I need you to change your words even if you don't believe them yet, because one day you're going to believe them and it's going to be getting better. Start with the cognitive. Work with the cognitive through the vocal, through the language. How important is this? Let me try to nail it down with a passage you already know. Matthew 12, starting with verse 33. Either make the tree good and the fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and the fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by its fruit. O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. But I say unto you that every idle word, not just the important words, the idle words that man shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. I cannot overemphasize how strong the connection is between the words that we choose to speak and our thought processes. They are tied together inexorably. Principle number two, assume that you don't know what's happening with a person. I mentioned this yesterday, and about a half a dozen of you or so said, "I really appreciate the fact that you point that out," because you really don't know what's happening in another person's life. And you don't. But this is a biblical principle that should guide us, that we shouldn't go off half-cocked. Now, it doesn't say it that way in the Bible, but that's the message. That's the warning for us. Proverbs chapter 18, verse 13, "He that answereth a matter before he heareth it," and I'm going to massage that a little bit for our purposes today, "before he sufficiently heareth it." Because there's a tendency on our part, and by the way, if you're trying to counsel somebody that you know well, this gets worse. In fact, if you are a professional counselor, you know, somebody who's really supposed to know what he's doing, you're not allowed to work with your family and your close friends. It's a violation of the American Counseling Association's ethics. Sometimes it's a violation of state law depending how that state regulates the counseling profession. Well, if my brother needs counseling, who knows my brother better than I do? I've known him since he was born. I'm the oldest. He's the youngest. I was there. I know him inside out. Why should... Here, I've gone through all this trouble to prepare myself, and you're telling me I can't even work with my own brother? No, that's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you, you're not qualified to work with your own brother. Well, how could that possibly... Nobody cares about him more than I do. That's the problem. You see, you think you know him. You think you know what's happening with him. You think you understand what every event in his life means to him because you know what the similar events meant to you. You think you've got him all figured out, which means that you're going to sit in one chair, he's going to sit in the other chair, and before he even begins speaking, you think you understand. Which means in this context, you are worthless to him. Because until you can approach this with an understanding that I don't know, and if I try to give an answer without sufficiently hearing the matter, I'm a fool. What good is a fool going to do him? That's why we don't work with people where we are so close to them. We're not allowed to because we're not qualified. By the way, this means you don't need a counselor in your congregation. You need like five counselors in five different congregations. Lady in our congregation back home called me, when was it? Tuesday. Called me Tuesday. I'm not so good with the days of the week. She calls me Tuesday. She says, can you give me the name of a counselor that's not Paul Meacham? I said, sure. She says, I don't want you to get the wrong... This is not that I don't... I said, it's okay. It's okay. I can't. And I did. Gave her the contact of a brother in Christ locally who's fully credentialed and capable. She said, I just want to be sure you understand. I said, it's okay. You and your husband are having trouble. You don't want to sit down in my living room and tell me all about what's happening privately in your lives and then look at me Sunday morning when I'm standing up front teaching the Bible class. And all the time, rather than paying attention to the fact that this is the beginning of David's reign, we're in 2 Samuel chapter 1, rather than paying attention to that, you're going to be sitting there looking at me saying, I wonder what he thinks about us now. I wonder if he's told anybody. I don't think he would. Would he? I don't think so. You need a place where you can come to worship, where you can be among friends and be safe. You need a place where you can study without having all of these other things intrude. You need to go see somebody not named Paul Meacham. She was okay with that. I mean, that's what she asked for. That's what she got. It's what she needed. We need to be sure that we understand that we need to hear the whole matter, because otherwise it's folly and shame, and we won't do them any good. Number three, recognize that you are usually hearing only one side of the story. This is particularly true in couples counseling. Proverbs chapter 18, verse 17 says, he that pleadeth his cause first seemeth just, but his neighbor comes and searches him out or examines him. What this means is that when the wife comes to you and tells you all of the terrible things that her husband's doing, number one, it's not your job to take sides at any point in the process. Number two, it would be foolish to ignore biblical principle and assume that what you're hearing is what is actually happening. Now, that doesn't mean that the lady's dishonest. It means she's human. And one of the attributes of being human is that we are oftentimes limited to being able to see things only from our own perspective. We genuinely believe that it is that way. And that's the reason we report it as being that way. But when someone else It would be nice if there was someone who could provide evidence that was dispassionate. You know, when mom and dad have a problem, when husbands and wives can't get along, there's no dispassionate people. Everybody is heavily emotionally invested. And usually, by the time they reach out for help, they are both deeply entrenched. It isn't like, you know, honey, I think we're developing a little bit of a problem. Oh? What do you think is happening? Well, it seems to me that we don't understand each other as well and don't seem to be nearly as willing to listen to each other. I think it would be wise for us to seek out some help so that maybe somebody could help us to develop some more efficient and effective communication techniques. What do you think? Well, dear, that sounds like a really good idea. Do you have anyone in mind? Well, you know, Brother Paul, he's pretty good at that, I hear. So let's go talk to him about it. I think that's a great idea. I tell you what, let's go to him immediately after services Sunday morning and see if he's got some time he could put us in his schedule. You know, I don't have any of those clients. If they were able to discuss that, like that, with each other and come to a consensus, they don't need me. If they've got something they need to work out, all they need is about 15 minutes of quiet. They'll work it out. Instead, by the time someone says, "We need help," I usually begin my very first session with them with a question. Before we go any further, I need to know, and I need to know the truth. Are we engaged in marriage counseling, or is this pre-divorce counseling? I need to know. Have you given up? Do you see your relationship as unsalvageable? If you do, you're going to have a hard time making any progress in it. If, however, you see this as something precious, if you still see your marriage as something that God designed, if you still see this as an opportunity for you to have support and health and happiness and blessedness here on earth with each other, there's no way we can possibly fail. But if you don't both see it that way, I'm probably not going to be able to help you. It's not just that I won't be able to help you. If you've decided it's beyond fixing, you're right. That's a hard meeting. That's a hard conversation to have. But they need to understand what they're up against and how their own attitude and their own behaviors are going to impact potential outcomes.
That's right.
And until they do, there's nothing you're going to be able to do for them that's substantive. So remember, you're only hearing one side of the story. Whether it's hers or whether it's his makes no difference. They are limited in being able to explain things according to their own perspective. How much? All right, I'm doing good here. All right, number four. Remember that all men are subject to self-deception. I used to think if people said something to me and it turned out not to be true, that meant they were liars. That's not true. They may have spoken something that was untrue, but they didn't know that. You see, they are at that moment so deceived, they believe that they're speaking the truth. And oftentimes, my role is to bring that confrontation, to take those two pieces of their life and set them before them, lay them in front of them, and say, this is what I've heard you say, but it doesn't seem to fit. Help me. Help me understand how these two pieces of your life fit together. And of course, oftentimes, they're forced to conclude that they can't. They don't fit. Both of these things can't be true. So, That doesn't mean that they were dishonest. It just means they were deceived, sometimes even by themselves. What does the Bible say? Galatians 6, verse 3, if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, what's the truth? He deceiveth himself. We have a saying back home, I don't know if y'all do this in Texas, if you could buy him for what he was worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth, you'd be all right. That's a person who thinks he's something when he's nothing. Why do I choose this particular... The Bible's filled with passages on self-deception. Why use this one? Because when mom and dad no longer can live in the same house without screaming and hollering at each other, when it's gotten to the point where it now is on the verge of or maybe has crossed the threshold of the fights turning physical rather than just verbal, there's a big problem with selfishness on the part of at least one, maybe both of them. But somewhere along the way, somebody has decided I and what I want and what I think is far more important than this marriage. And I'm going to have my way. You say, oh, nobody ever says that. Husbands and wives live it every day. They say it much more powerfully than their words ever could. They continually give the message, I don't care what you want. This is the way it's going to be. That won't work. Ye husbands, live with them according to knowledge. And what should your perspective of your wife be? What is that thing that you should always keep back in your mind? Somebody said, that she's the weaker vessel. You know, that's not where that verse ends up. She's a sister in Christ. And you treating her this way is cutting off your access to God by prayer. You're hindering your own prayers. That marriage won't work that way. And your service to God won't either. That's not my idea. That's the Bible's idea. And it says, if you don't understand this, if you think you're really something, you're deceiving yourself. You need to take a step back. You need to begin to see yourself within this relationship as God sees you, not as the world has influenced you to see yourself. I went to visit her in her home. It was a mobile trailer that had a thing, a kind of a lean-to thing built onto the back of it. In walking through the home, it was like walking through a dungeon. It was dark. There were curtains over the windows, but they were thick and they were drawn. There was a little lamp with a very dim bulb in it that was over in the corner. And that was pretty much the only illumination in the house. As you walked through the kitchen portion of this, I knew where I would not be eating ever. The dishes were piled up, food caked on them. There were ants on the counters. It was just awful. And this was where they lived. And in the process of talking with them, one of the things that I learned was that he had been actively employed full-time, 40 hours a week, for years. And she never saw a penny of that money. And she never was going to see a penny of that money either, because that's my hunting and fishing money. They'd been married nearly 30 years. She had worked a full-time job all of those years because somebody had to keep that little dim bulb in the corner on. And her money ran the home. His money was his money, and it was for hunting and fishing, which he did every day without fail. And this will never change. You think you're something when you don't even care for your own? Seems to me, I read in a book that says if a man does not provide for his own, he's worse than an infidel. Didn't I read that? And you having hunting and fishing money doesn't provide for your family. You deceive yourself. There was nothing that he could tell me about that relationship that I could rely upon. Every word out of his mouth came from a self-deceived source. So I listened to him. I did what we call attending. I looked him in the eye. I listened actively. Occasionally I would give him minimal encouragers. Yeah, I see. Okay. Tell me more. I would even occasionally reflect some content that he said. So you're feeling all pressured by this. There was nothing that he said to me that I could use. Because he didn't understand what was going on. He's self-deceived. So, when you've got a couple there in your office, and there they are, and here's what their life is, you have to ask yourself, how much of this information can I actually use? Or how much of it comes from self-deceived sources? Man or woman. That's the worst example I could think of, so I gave you that one. Not good. Number last. Well, I'm doing good. All right. The most accurate consideration of a situation is usually a blind, objective appraisal. Now, y'all know where I'm going, right? Nathan shows up at David's house and says, let me tell you a story. There was a man who was rich. He had flocks and herds. And his neighbor was a poor man. He had one little, how do we say it, folks? Ee-wee lamb? He had one little ee-wee lamb. This lamb is described more as a pet than livestock, but the man who was rich had a visitor, and he needed to feed that man. So he went to his neighbor, and he stole from him his little lamb, and he put that lamb to death, and he fed this traveler that had come by. And David, you've got to remember, David was a shepherd before we found out he was anything else. And he hears about this, and he is enraged at this behavior. This man deserves to die and to fulfill that lamb, returning him fourfold. Which, by the way, fit exactly with what the law of Moses said should have happened in that situation. And then Nathan looks at him, and he says, "Thou art the man." Now, where did that appraisal of the situation come from? Did it come from David, the wife stealer? Would Nathan have gotten the same appraisal from David if he had said, let me tell you a story. There was a king, and he went up on his roof one day, and he saw a woman bathing, and he wanted her, and he was the king. Whatever the king wants, the king gets. He called for her, he took her, and she was with child. And when he found that out, he went and got her husband back from the front, and he tried to get him to lay with her so he'd think it was his baby. And when he found out he was dealing with a man more honorable than himself, he sent him back with his own death instructions. He murdered him. What do you think, king? What should happen to him? This is a great time for David to begin the tap dance. Well, I think you have to take into consideration that there's a lot of things that people wouldn't think about. There are a lot of different factors that bear on this, and we need to think about all of them carefully before we go off half-cocked and do something. But when he told him about a man that stole another man's lamb, David gave an honest, accurate, objective, blind, he didn't know who he was talking about, appraisal of the situation. If you can get people to think about the elements of their own lives in these purely objective ways, they'll do your work for you. They will give you the answers that they need to hear. You can do it. Turn on your brain. Think about where this conversation needs to end up. Backtrack. And then start the process that will get you there. It's a biblical principle that's very effective in counseling. I've thrown more at you in one day than you can possibly use in a year. So let me stop here, because I am out of time. You will feel overwhelmed by what people bring to you. Don't panic. You will feel like this is above my pay grade, one of you said to me earlier this morning, that I'm out of my depth, that I'm not qualified to deal with this. Let me encourage you to begin your response to these clients by saying, I got to be honest with you, I don't really feel like I'm up to this. This is more than I feel prepared to deal with. But let's talk about the things that you and I both know to be true. And bring them back to God's Word. Open the book. Everything that was ever written in a psychology book that has been proved to work was already in the Bible in principle. Now, that's a fact. Okay? Take them back to God's Word and say, read that for me. Don't read it to them. Ask them to read it. When they get to the end, don't tell them what it said. Preachers, please, I know you make your living telling people what it says. Don't tell them what it says. Ask him, what does that say? And then you ask the next question. How does that instruction from God affect what you should do next? You've either got an honest man who will be drawn to what he needs, because the gospel will be sufficient for all purposes, or you've got a dishonest man and you never had a chance to start with. I don't know if there's ever any way that I could be helpful to you from this point forward. If there is, you can go to amridgeuniversity.edu. Contact information is there. I would be happy to be helpful to you any way that I could. Just keep loving the people that you're working with. Everything else is going to work out okay. So, thank you.